Welcome to the Jazz Shapers podcast from Mishkon Dorea. What you're about to hear was originally broadcast on Jazz FM. However, the music has been cut due to rights issues.
This is Jazz Shapers with Elliot Moss on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishkon Dorea. It's business, but it's personal. Listening colour.
Welcome to Jazz Shapers with me, Elliot Moss, bringing the shapers of the business world together with the musicians shaping jazz, soul and blues. My guest today is Cameron Leslie, co-founder of Fabric, the iconic London nightclub and record label. While working as a hospitality and leisure consultant for Deloitte, Cameron supported Keith Riley, his future co-founder, with his vision for an anti-brand to the big nightclubs of the time. Keith sought a venue with a warehouse mentality, a platform for the unsung heroes of electronic music. In 1999, Cameron and Keith launched Fabric in a former cold storage facility in Farringdon, London, gaining a reputation for experimental, pioneering programming and for nurturing underground artists and scenes. Having steered Fabric out of administration after the collapse of its sister club and having survived the loss of their license after two tragedies at the club, Cameron and Keith would then face the uncertainties of the COVID pandemic. But Fabric, voted number one club in the world four times, yes, four times, is now 25 years old. Who knew? And going strong, with its founders diversifying the brand and celebrating it globally. I'm really pleased we've grabbed you, Cameron. I've been talking about having you on the programme for a while. You didn't know we were tracking you.
No, I didn't.
No. Because we are sinister. Jazz Shapers is an incredibly sinister program. It's not something you said before, but you're absolutely right. But Fabric and the world of music, not sinister.
Not sinister at all.
No, all about giving people happiness.
Absolutely. That's what we do. So, yes, 25 years of happiness.
That's amazing. I mean, I don't know how old you are. We're probably of a similar age. You might be a few years younger than
50
me.
50 now.
50, yeah. Just 3 years. 3 years separates us, Cameron. Important 3 years, though, you're thinking. Very important. But, you know, a 25-year-old talking about the world of music and a 50-year-old, different thing, no?
Totally different, yeah. Very naive going into that at that point and probably served, well, I can't talk for Keith, but certainly served me very well at that time, I think. Fast forward to 50 and I was faced with a project like that with no experience. I don't think I would have done it. But yeah, at the time it was...
You don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. And, you know, it was a really, really different time to now anyway in terms of launching something like that. And so I think we benefited from being able to make, not necessarily mistakes, but we were able to correct certain things that weren't necessarily right, and it was a lot more of a forgiving time then, certainly in terms of opening the other venue later on, which was born into a completely unforgiving time. It allowed us to be able to shape it in a way that, you know, we meaningfully carried it on for, you know, the next sort of couple of decades. So yeah, it was a great time to be able to launch something. So
and your background and the way you met Keith, you were a stand-up proper person from the world of consulting.
Job. Yes.
And then you go into the murky, not sinister, we've established that, but murky world. And actually, joking aside, the world of nightclubs anywhere in the world. And at university, I had a night at a nightclub. It was called Stimulus for those people unfortunate enough to be in Leeds around 1991, 1990. But music, and I was watching a Man United documentary recently, music and culture and the world that we lived in without social media, without the internet, it was the thing you did to get away. And 1999, not dissimilar. Now it's a totally different ballgame in terms of serving up that experience. At that point, did you feel like you were sort of in the middle of something really important culturally versus I'm just running a business?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, we wanted Fabric to be the best on every single level. And for someone like me, who studied hospitality, did a hospitality degree, worked at, you know, five-star hotels, then was working in consulting for Deloitte. The real strong appeal, aside from the fact that, you know, I was a music fan, but I didn't want to go into the music industry, was the fact that we could create a completely new way of running a venue that was completely different to anything else that was around at that particular time.
And was that just doing things differently? Simple as that? Yeah. Or was it your vision, you and Keith going, we're going to do it this way because it's better?
It wasn't necessarily doing it differently just to be sort of antagonistic or disrupting, which wasn't a word back in those days.
No.
It was to try and do it as best as we possibly could, whether that was, you know, the toilet attendants actually weren't standing over a load of aftershaves and Tic Tacs and, you had to put a pound in the pot, they were actually cleaning the toilets. And there wasn't male and female toilets. There was unisex toilets because it was more efficient. You got more cubicles. You know, the cloakroom had airline tickets rather than raffle tickets. You know, these were all just tiny little things that contributed to people forgetting about those things and concentrating on the sound system, the dance floor, the artists that were playing. If you forgot about those operational things, that the security were polite and trained well and did their job properly, you'd forget about them rather than thinking, oh, I can't go back to that place because they always lose my coat, or I can never get a drink, or, you know, the music's great, sound system's great, but, you know, it's such a pain to do it. So, you know, we really concentrated on all of those aspects of the service element to make them forgettable. Yeah. And, you know, and that was, that for me was like a real strong pull, is, you know, doing something properly where we saw so many people not doing it right. And, you know, we really pushed hard from day one and in terms of, you know, setting the scene as to what Fabric was going to be about.
In 2024, they call it the UX, the user experience, and there it was back in 1999. And Cameron Leslie, my business shaper today, was already doing it. There you go, new language for the same thing. Cameron Leslie is my business shaper, and he is the co-founder of Fabric. And actually, I should give the other businesses a name. I sort of touched on them before, but you've got a Web3 social gaming platform.
Yep.
Which you founded. Are you still involved and co-founder director at
Midas? Yeah. Correct.
And that's the interior solutions business, yep. Which sounds like an extraordinary business to be involved in, has nothing to do with anything else you
do.
No. How did that happen? So, is this right? UK-based designer, yep. Manufacturer of modular steel partitioning, yep. For commercial industrial spaces.
Yeah,
as you do.
It's the obvious thing you do after.
Obviously,
Microsoft.
Cameron. Yeah, yeah, but yeah. Is it? Was it?
No,
totally...
it was. It found us.
Okay.
It was a little bit of an antidote, if I have to be honest. After the closure of the venue, the other venue, the big venue, Matter, which we founded down in the O2. And I came out of that and I just decided that I'd probably had enough of opening bricks and mortar spaces at that point. And myself and my other long-term partner, Gary, we were looking at a few things, and he had invested in a similar company about 10 years before, and the engineers had come to him, or the main engineer had come to him and myself, looking for an exit route out of the company they were in, and they wanted to create a startup, and you had a ready-made team that was coming there. And so, you know, he asked me what I thought, and I knew nothing about engineering, but they knew everything about that. What they didn't know was about, you know, taking a business to market and, you know, branding it up and the sales channels and all the important things that you needed to get something like that going. So we backed it, built a big factory up in Shropshire, and, yeah, we've been working in advanced manufacturing and vaccines, pharma, life science, healthcare, those kind of specialist,
I mean, amazing.
Interiors. And
but you're doing that over there. You're not just the nightclub impresario. In fact, it sounds like actually it's more like you're the person who makes this stuff work.
Well, I am incredibly lucky that in each of those businesses there are proper specialists, you know, that look after those specialist businesses. You know, that it's certainly not me juggling and running around those. I'd lend some support and help.
Is it the same with the Web3 piece as well?
Yeah, exactly the same.
So they need you, Cameron, to basically help them understand how to run and grow their business.
Yeah, and there's a lot of synergy between each of those, as much as they're in completely
different
areas. Right,
so we've got nightclubs and music and record labels.
Manufacturing
over there, and then we've got a technology business.
Correct.
And what would you say are the similarities overarching all of
You've certainly got branding, you've got sales principles, you've got back-end governance and administration, of which, you know, we take pride in the way that we run our businesses. Some of those elements are centralised, some of them are not. But, you know, there are plenty of individuals that cross over each of those businesses that we use in terms of social media and the way that we go about branding and styling things, even if we don't necessarily, at startup point, don't have the assets and the case studies and the background to be able to do it. You can actually create an identity which gives you an immediate presence, which allows you to hopefully fast track those entities and become players in their own field. So,
but there must be a sensibility, like with the music thing. I think it would be impossible for me personally to be involved in something I had absolutely no connection to. So for you, obviously, music plays a role. technology plays a role, or is it not at all?
Honestly and truly, I didn't go into any of those because I was passionate about gaming, or I was suddenly passionate about clean rooms and controlled environments. They're not things that
really?
I
really. You don't talk about clean rooms and controlled environments.
Surprisingly, at dinner parties, that's not what it is.
I'm really missing out. Yeah. You are missing out on that topic.
But I do. I now actually really do enjoy and have become interested in them, having learned from specialists about them and being in conversations alongside them and meeting, you know, architects and contractors and end users, that actually as an engineering business, I find it fascinating. And it's the complete polar opposite from something like Fabric, where you have creatives and it's a totally different mentality and mindset. And I just enjoy the sort of polarity of those worlds and the individuals that are in them, because they're all at different phases of their lives. They've all got different competing forces on them and they have different individuals involved. And, you know, I just can provide a little bit of glue sometimes to those different entities where they're needed. But as I say, they do have proper specialists that drive them, you know, day in, day out. And that's not me.
I'm not going to accuse you of being the person that puts the things together, don't worry. Much more from my guest coming up soon. That's Cameron Leslie. He'll be back in a couple of minutes. Right now, though, we're going to hear a clip from the Michigan Academy Digital Sessions, which can be found on all the major podcast platforms. MDRX's CEO, Tom Grogan, talks about Web3, the next iteration of the internet, and what businesses and individuals need to be thinking about when formulating their Web3 strategies and pursuing valuable, impactful projects.
Mishcon Academy Digital Sessions. Conversations on the legal topics affecting businesses and individuals today.
How should a business assess how urgently they should consider the impact of Web3 on their business?
I think responsible businesses should certainly be thinking about it and engaging with it. And for us, it always comes down to the why. If you or parts of your business are doing things and you're not sure why, please stop. Please stop doing random things. And if your reason for launching an NFT is to appear innovative, you're like 3 years too late. So please always return to the why. What are we as an organization today? What would we like to be as an organization in 10 years? And then figure out how, if at all, Web3 forms a part of that. The other big recommendation we make is to make sure that whatever you do, make sure that it is inching you organizationally further towards that target end state goal. We always use Disney as a bit of a pinup example of how to do this really, really well. They dipped their toe in the water into Web3, launched their Golden Moments collection, which was a series of relatively simple NFTs that were little gold statuettes of famous Disney characters in iconic moments. And that was interesting and valuable, and some people bought it and some people didn't. But importantly, they used it as an internal organizational learning tool that empowered them to know as an organization what it meant to do Web3. They since have massively expanded their operations. They refer to the metaverse, and it's a lovely turn of phrase, as the next great frontier of storytelling.
The Michigan Academy Digital Sessions. To access advice for businesses that is regularly updated, please visit michigan.com. Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishkondareya. It's business, but it's personal.
You can enjoy all our former Business Shapers on the Jazz Shapers podcast. And you can hear this very program again if you pop Jazz Shapers into your favorite podcast platform, if there is such a thing and you have an emotional connection with one. My guest today is Cameron Leslie, co-founder of Fabric, the London nightclub and record label 2, and a whole bunch of other stuff, as you've been hearing, he's involved in. But going back to Fabric, I interviewed James Brown, the founder of Loaded, not that long ago. And there's a person who was living and breathing the music scene. He would go under the heading of specialist, to use your accurate language. There must have been, though, for you, a buzz, even though you weren't necessarily the person deciding who the roster was going to be of DJs or what the aesthetics might be on one particular night versus another. That period of time before you opened the second club, was it a lot of fun, or were you still really consumed in making sure this operation worked more than the fun that you were meant to be having?
Well, it definitely went in phases. The launch was, and I'll say the launch was kind of the launch year, the first year, was really difficult. We, you know, none of us had any experience of opening anything like that, or even opening anything. I was 25. And so while I had hotel and hospitality experience of being involved in hotels, I wasn't necessarily opening them and launching them from fresh. So it was completely new and there was no manual and, you know, we weren't able to necessarily reference others that we that were particularly helpful. So we
and
just,
also, just for people that aren't familiar with the fabric piece, the size of the venue took how many people?
So capacity is 2,000, which is close to 2,000. But I think more importantly, particularly for those early phases, it was the demand for it for people that couldn't get in. So you probably had 2 to 3 times capacity outside trying to get in. So
and how did you manage those crowds?
Yeah, I mean, it from day one, it caught us so hard. And I think we opened, we had 3 nights, then we had pause for 2, and then I think we had 42 nights on the trot after that. Now, this isn't a well-oiled machine that you now have the team that you trust and the operations that you know how to respond to something like that. So it was just seat of your pants stuff for quite a while. And the team that I had in place, I think my operations manager was sent home sort of night 4 with mental exhaustion. And I sort of carried it for, you know, a couple of months, just literally on my own on the operational side. And then we started to catch up with ourselves and be able to start bringing in the right people, found sort of a new general manager, a new operations manager, heads of security, all of these kind of individuals that the launch team then got replaced by a specialist team that we were able to handpick and identify for the business. But I would say on a sort of a, you know, perfectionist level, it was definitely a full year of fine-tuning before I kind of was able to look at it and think, do you know what, this is now working really, really well. On the front side, on the public-facing side and on the booking and curation side, it just took off from day one. And, you know, as much as I was talking about being able to find direction, that was positive direction on things and being able to make, not necessarily mistakes, but you try things and you think, do you know what, we could do better doing this and then forging those particular sort of directions on, you know, various sort of, you know, music, things like our Fabric Live night on Fridays started as once every 6 weeks. And we were doing things with other promoters, other bookers on those other nights. And then we found, you know what, we're actually doing this really well. So we flipped it around and did 3 nights a month as Fabric Live and 1 external. And then ultimately we flipped that into 4 every single Friday, became Fabric Live. So we were learning about our ability to do things really well in our own space and how we wanted to shape it all and have total creative control.
But you had to be fast. There was iteration at
correct.
Speed.
Yeah, totally. And it is sometimes a little bit like a super tanker in that bookings aren't done 1 week in advance. You're doing these 6 months, 8 months in advance. So, you know, back then we were probably doing it 6, 8 weeks in advance, a lot closer and tighter. But still, you know, your turning circle isn't that tight. It's a couple of months out. So.
But you do learn. When I first started DJing when I was 15, you learn a lot when it's live.
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
More than you do in all sorts of other environments when there's an audience.
Correct.
And stuff's happening in real time.
And it's unforgiving as well.
Totally.
You know, if you get it wrong,
and
you can get it, and particularly on the operational level, if you get it wrong, you get it really wrong. And, you know, then you've really got to try and recover that quickly. So a lot of our setup was about not getting things wrong and not ever being in that place that it could fall down. And you know, we've had very few of those over the years, considering, you know, we put on what's close to sort of 2 Glastonbury's every year in terms of numbers of people coming into central London. So, you know, it's a big operation.
Things have gone wrong.
Mm.
You have had crises. I mentioned it at the beginning of the programme. Hedonism, and again, this was part of the culture of it being dark, the lights are off, it's fun, lots of young people, stuff happens, stuff is consumed. What have you learnt personally and professionally about having to deal with that? Because that is, it's almost like, you know, it's like you put music and you put certain forms of life together with other things which aren't necessarily quite as attractive.
Mm.
How have you managed? I'm being euphemistic here around the world of drugs and things, but how have you managed to ensure that people have fun, people are safe?
Well, from day one, we've run a straight operation, and that's at least the founding core of that. And so everything beyond that, we've had to contend with. Those are the challenges that go in and around nighttime economy. Cash, less so now, but back in the heyday, you'd have cash, drink, drugs, sex, people, any combination of those together is quite a potent opportunity to go wrong. So those challenges from day one have been something we've had to contend with. And, you know, we were quite lucky in that, you know, the police and the Met Police, when we first opened, we sort of said to them, what sort of venue do you want us to be? Do you want us to be completely open and transparent and, you know, we deal with these challenges together? Or do we do it like many of the venues around at that time and, you know, you deal with things behind closed doors, whether that's meting out justice in a back alley somewhere or flushing things down the toilet? And we never did that. And we were given a very positive, collaborative remit with the Met from day one in terms of the way we did things.
But and, you went to talk to them.
And we talked to them and yeah. We pioneered, you know, a lot of things in terms of the way that we would take drugs out of circulation and those would be held and the audit process of handing that over and the destruction of those. And you know, for a long time, we were held up as a real bastion of best practice by them. And, you know, they would bring problem licensees down to the venue to see how it could be done at scale. And, you know, together we actually did, you know, a lot of programs together. So you were able to ride out the things that come across, you know, in your way that you don't plan on wanting to see and deal with.
Can't unsee it, though.
You can't unsee it, and you have to deal with it. And, you know, you want to be able to have a partner like the police to be able to make sure that you're able to do that together. And
they get a bad rap, I mean, generally, yeah. Don't they? But it sounds like your experience with them has been
by and large positive.
Yeah, you're always going to have bad actors. That's the same. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's amplified when it's in law enforcement parts of the world of business, as it were. That learning that you've had, and it sounds like it's been quite hard. You talked earlier about, you know, you've been the operational person, the person ensuring that the thing works and that you've had other specialists. But I imagine it was quite emotional when there was a sense that this journey might end, when Fabric was going to be no more. So as much as Cameron's a cool customer and is going to ensure that the thing works, the machine's working, the thought of the machine not existing was a bit of a different thing.
Well, weirdly, I've become a little bit sort of desensitized over the years.
Have you?
Strangely, it's odd having a business that you've always had a feeling could end at some point. I don't feel that about the others. Anything else I've been involved in, I've never thought, oh God, that manufacturing business could just finish next week. Or there's always existential threats to something like a licensed premises. Mm. And it's quite an odd existence. And so there have been times when you've been facing that we've certainly faced that, you know, quite real prospect that, you know, it might not reopen. But I've got to say, you know, we've always had sort of a very strong belief that we'd be able to get ourselves out of that, fight our way out.
And that hasn't exhausted you? You don't look tired from it.
At times it has. You know,
living on the edge is really good fun. Yeah. Tons of adrenaline, but actually it must take its toll, because when the adrenaline suddenly drops off, the night's shut, it's 4 a.m, you're going home, wherever it is, like, and then you go, oh, back again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm fortunate that I don't do, you know, the night aspect anymore. Yeah. But certainly at the end of phases of those kind of periods, actually I found the period afterwards to sometimes be a lot harder than the actual period of fighting, because I think we've sort of realised that we're real scrappers now when it comes to, you know, making sure we fight for the existence of our business, for the employment of close to 200 people. You know, this is a serious thing for us, and we've just made sure that each and every time that we've been in that position, we've taken on the best possible people we could, whether that's licensing solicitors and barristers and legal brains to be able to help us. But we've also dug deep in terms of our own ability to get ourselves out of those situations. Something like COVID, of course, you know, completely beyond, you know, your ability to buy your way out or think your way out or fight your way out of that situation. So, you know, it's not always within your, you know, remit and grasp to be able to get out of those. So you've just got to be able to navigate as best as possible to get yourself ultimately to that place. But the after bit, perhaps when you've lost momentum or you've got to try and get that momentum back up again, that's sometimes the harder bit, because you really have to dig into different reserves to get the team going and to be able to get yourself, you know, into a different place. So, yeah, I've learned that a few times.
The after bit, nicely put. Final chat coming up with Cameron. We've also got some Bill Lawrence for you here on Jazz FM. That's in just a moment. Don't go anywhere.
Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishkondareya. It's business, but it's personal.
I'm with Cameron Leslie just for a few more minutes, and we've been talking about 25 quite eventful years, and here we are celebrating now. I mean, I'm talking about Fabric, the main event for you, because obviously that's been the consistent thread right the way through that period. Now you're here, we're after the after bit.
Mm.
There's some energy in the system, and now you're starting to experiment with this brand Fabric. There's the label, and there's all these other events that you're putting on around the country. Is there a sense of pride, Cameron? I mean, you strike me as incredibly pragmatic and not someone to sit there and go, look what I just did. But is there a moment where you've gone, we've survived quite a few scares here, the patient's still alive, and actually the patient's looking quite healthy?
Mm.
Is that how it's feeling?
As far as good phases go and good times go,
I love this guy. He's already going, well, I'm not going to tell you it's great.
I don't want to tempt fate, but at the moment, you know, we're in a really good phase of life, and some of the things that are going on, particularly in the 25th year, but I would say post-COVID, I was talking about momentum, and, you know, one of the learnings that we had from the closure in 2016, 2017 reopening was that we came out quite slowly and reopened cautiously. And when we shut for COVID, one of the real learnings that we had from that previous closure was that when we reopened and got the green light to do it, we were going to come out the traps really hard and create that momentum quick. And we did that. And I think we benefited in the last couple of years. I mean, we're coming up to 3 years in July since reopening. And we benefited greatly from that. And we also benefited from a lot of the relationships, new relationships that we built during COVID as a consequence of the Arts Council grant, which we were very lucky to get, a very generous one. And we established relationships with other London spaces, iconic spaces like Royal Albert Hall, V&A, and St Paul's Cathedral, bizarrely. And we've put events on and done things in these kind of alternative spaces, alternative to somewhere like Fabric. You know, last September, for example, we did the first ever contemporary live music event in St Paul's Cathedral for 2,000 people. And it was absolutely amazing for the first time in 400 years, you know, you had some form of electronic music being played in there with all the challenges that go in and around the acoustics in a space like that. And yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. They took a massive, well, we didn't feel it was a risk, but they took a risk on us and, you know, have invited us to come back and do another one this year. And, you know, there's only three shows a year. So to be able to do that a second time this year, which we're doing in September, it's those sorts of things that, you know, we're sort of opening ourselves up to doing alternative cultural spaces.
And being relevant.
And being relevant. And, you know, and suddenly these venues and these spaces are looking at our audience as being relevant, and they're wanting to invite different audiences into these spaces. And I think in a post-COVID world, that's actually a really great thing that's going on in London now, is you're seeing these kind of cross-pollination of and culture clashes that previously, pre-COVID, I wouldn't have imagined could have happened. But actually you're seeing these kind of mix of audiences, and, you know, we've got Great Museum of London just opening just across the road from us. Or London Museum, I think they are now.
Yeah, London
I better
Museum.
Get it right. And, you know, fantastic space and you know, right on our doorstep. And the things that we're going to be able to potentially do together there, you would never sort of put those two entities together. But, you know, they're fantastic
That's
people. They've got really great forward vision. And, you know, it's these kind of things that we're looking to sort of do now as we enter our sort of 25th year.
And alongside that, you're still excited by the variety that you have, the Web3 stuff, the manufacturing,
totally.
That all that works for you personally.
Yeah, definitely interested in, you know, I don't know where that might lead, and I don't know what other things, you know, might come my way, but I definitely don't want to be, you know, pigeonholed just in sort of one area or sector.
There's like not much danger
variety.
Of that happening, Cameron.
No.
You'd have to sort of get rid of quite a few things
yes.
before someone put you in a little wee pigeonhole called that's
yeah.
what he does.
No, I think I've shed that moniker a long time ago, so I haven't got to worry about that.
It's been really good talking to you.
Thank you.
And good luck in this 25th year for Fabric.
Thanks, Elliot.
Good luck with the obvious combination of Web3 and manufacturing. I mean, sorry I didn't see the connection before. And carry on having fun. Just before I let you go, what's your song choice and why have you chosen?
So Azimuth, Morning, great, influential band, remixed by a lot of people within sort of Fabric world, Jazzanova, Ashley Beadle. We're lucky enough to have them play 10 years ago at the club on a special one-off sort of live show. it's Brazil, 1970s. What can you not love about this track? It's fantastic. So, yeah, that's my choice.
The inimitable sound of Azimuth with Morning, the song choice of my business shaper, Cameron Leslie. He talked about enabling people to forget about the operational things, specifically in the context of the experience in a nightclub, but really think about that more broadly in business. He talked about having proper specialists in his businesses. He works in a lot of things and humbly said, you need those domain experts. But boy, is that absolutely true. He talked about the management of the fabric business being full of real scrappers, fighting for the existence of the business itself and for the 200 people in it. And finally, that lovely thought about the after bit. When stressful things have happened, when there's been a phase of heavy duty stuff going on, there will be an impact, and just be aware of it coming later because you're going to need to deal with it. That's it from me and Jazz Shapers. Have a lovely weekend.
Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishkondorea. It's business, but it's personal.
We hope you enjoyed that edition of Jazz Shapers. You'll find hundreds more guests available for you to listen to in our archive. To find out more, just search Jazz Shapers in iTunes or your favourite podcast platform, or head over to mishkon.com/Jazz Shapers.